Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Granard Center for the Performing Arts, a home for contemporary theatrical events in March and April. City Company teams up with musical ensemble Rachel's in Systems Layers. British and American companies Modi Rodi and the Builders Association present Aladdin. And the U of I Department of Theater offers Marisol and Aloha Say the Pretty Girls. For more information or tickets, visit GranardCenter.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we begin another week's worth of programs. When the Internet was born, there were many people who predicted that it would truly democratize journalism, in effect making it possible for anyone or almost anyone to be a publisher. Now, it seems that it took a little time to get to that point, but that in fact, now with the increasing popularity and increasing numbers of web logs, sometimes called blogs for short, that day has finally come. And we have seen that these online commentators and news sources have become very influential. For example, just two recent examples, it was bloggers who seemed to poke holes in the CBS story having to do with President Bush and his service in the National Guard before he was president. Also, there was another case where a blogger seemed to have forced the resignation of Eason Jordan, who ran CNN because of some comments that he had made about his belief that American forces might be targeting journalists in Iraq. And there are other examples as well. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll talk a little bit about today's alternative media and also look at the ways that newspapers, but not just newspapers, are responding to this challenge. And our guest for the program is Steve Luxenburg. He is assistant managing editor of The Washington Post. He is in charge of the Outlook section at the Post, and in that capacity, edits the Sunday section of analysis and commentary and supervises a staff of five. Before joining Outlook, he directed the Washington Post investigative special project staff, first as the deputy assistant managing editor and later as the assistant managing editor. And during the time he was there, the staff won a number of major awards, including a Pulitzer Prize, which was shared by Leon Dash, who was at the Post then, and right now he's on the faculty of the U of I. He's here visiting. That is, Mr. Luxenburg is here visiting. We'll be talking on this very subject a little bit later today, but we're pleased that he could be here and spend a little bit of time with us chatting as well. Questions, of course, from people who are listening are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do have a toll-free line as well. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, comments, you're welcome to call. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks.
I appreciate it. To begin, I thought, because as we were chatting a little bit before we got going, not very long ago on the show, someone used the term blog, and we were talking about blogs, and a caller actually called in and said, I'm sorry, I have no idea what it is you're talking about. So we should not take for granted that everyone listening actually knows what a weblog or a blog is. So let's start there. What is it we're talking about?
Well, I was on a plane coming here on Sunday and sat next to a young woman who clearly was a U of I student because of her age and the fact we were going to Champaign. And I told her what I was talking about today. And she said, what's a blog? So you're absolutely right. Most people don't know what they are. And yet 8 million bloggers are out there, according to an estimate that was done recently by a web research firm. Blogging ranges from people who are just individuals who create a web page and who start a blog, meaning that they want to express themselves and their views, to people who are professional journalists or writers who might be in a particular situation and are filing reports that are not published in a newspaper or broadcast on radio or television. For example, the Washington Post now is offering a blog of its baseball writer so that every day, if you want to know what's going on in spring training, you know, whose fingernail has been torn off in catching a baseball, the beat writer will tell you the little things he doesn't really think are worth publishing in the space-limited section of the Post. There are newsletters, for example, in the Eason Jordan situation you talked about. Eason Jordan, for those of you who might not know, was the chief news executive of CNN. And his resignation may have been for other reasons that are internal. I'm always suspicious of anybody who says that a single thing causes somebody's resignation. But he was speaking at a World Economic Forum panel in Switzerland. And there was some dispute about what he actually said, but he certainly used the word targeted to suggest that U.S. troops had perhaps targeted journalists. accidentally is what he said later he meant. He didn't know that they didn't know they were journalists. This was the, quote, collateral damage of the war. That was the actual discussion being held. But he, after this, the World Economic Forum actually hired somebody to be the blogger, the official blogger for the World Economic Forum. And then the blogging community, which means some portion of this 8 million, picked up this comment, and they begin to have a discussion among themselves is really what begins to happen. And then things you read things later on, and it's a distortion of what was actually said, not intentionally, but because of the sort of old telephone game we played as children where I repeat it to you and you repeat it. And by the time it gets to the, you know, sixth or seventh iteration, who knows what they're really talking about.
Yeah. Well, I guess on the face of it, then, one of the problems with the weblog is it's someone's online journal that is offered there for anybody who wants to come along and read it. That's what a lot of it is. But there are other people that are actually hoping to have influence, as much influence as the Washington Post or the New York Times or as CBS. But that the problem, I suppose, as journalists look at it, the problem is that no one's vetting any of this. That is, on your weblog, you could write anything that you want. Presumably at the Post, there are editors, there are people who are looking over the stories, there are people who are responsible for checking facts. Reporters are supposed to provide information on their sources. The reporter cannot simply write anything he or she wants, but a blogger can. And they could be right, they could be wrong, they could have access to Grind. That seems to be the one of the big challenges as far as the mainstream media is concerned. Here is a kind of a enterprise that they have to, in a sense, compete with, but operates under completely different rules.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things is that you can ignore a blog that is just someone's opinion. Mm-hmm. I would suspect that most of what is said every day on the web is enjoyed by the people who are reading it, but doesn't really affect the mainstream media, which is a term that has been created, I think, to distinguish it from the alternative media of the web, but is used among the bloggers with some sarcasm. The mainstream media is something to be taunted, feared, poked, prodded, etc. You're correct in saying that it's not edited. There are, though, some that have begun to morph into journalism, and they know this, and it worries them. So, for example, one of the online media actually has a convention now each year, like the mainstream media, mm-hmm. And they are talking about whether to develop a blogging code of ethics, which is patterned after, of all things, the Society of Professional Journalism code of ethics, and it includes such things as being fair, being accurate, looking for alternative views, et cetera. And so once that happens, you begin to ask, well, if they're like us being journalists, then what's the difference between blogging and journalism? What legal questions begin to arise? Is it libelous or slanderous for someone to say something in their weblog that we in journalism would not be able to say? Or we would have to have facts to support that. I think these are the kinds of questions that are going to get sorted out, and they're going to get sorted out the more power that blogging has. Listeners might want to know, well, what kind of power do they have? In the CBS matter that you referred to, Dan Rather's situation where they put a report on about President Bush's National Guard service, the CBS had said they had documents that later turned out that the CBS said they could not verify the documents after they had already aired them on the air. The blogging community immediately, it wasn't really a community, there were people out there with expertise in document verification. And within 12 hours, in some cases within a couple of hours, people were questioning the documents. Now, this could have been people who were ideologically based, who wanted to defend President Bush and were just questioning the documents, but they had real specific evidence that it was unlikely that these documents had been created in the way and manner in which they were shown on CBS. Some in the blogging community have taken credit for this. I think that's kind of interesting because in some senses, if you're if you're producing facts that undermine a national news report, then you're committing journalism. And if you're committing journalism, you begin to care about, well, wait a minute, what are your facts and how verified are your facts and how do I know to believe you? At the same time, I'm not touting my own newspaper, I just happen to know it because I work there, Michael Dobbs, who was the reporter who had written our account of what CBS had said that night, began to question the documents himself. He was quite upset when he heard the blogging community begin to take credit for this because, of course, we're all egotists here. And I said to him, well, Michael, why isn't it just the old tipster who's dropping a dime, to use that phrase, you know, putting a dime in the payphone, and calling you up and saying, you know, I'm suspicious of these documents. Why are you worried about it? Well, the answer is because the tipster was unknown to the public, and he didn't have to compete with the tipster. But the bloggers were out there writing their own things. Many of them love, you get a kind of person who had no avenue, no way to give you his or her point of view. People who are retired who love the idea of being able to verify documents and tell you why this document wasn't correct, they were having a ball. I don't think many of them had no reason for trying to tear down CBS, but there is a portion of the blogging community which is ideologically based on the left and on the right and which was interested in trying to show up CBS.
Yeah. Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus, Steve Luxenberg. He's assistant managing editor of the Washington Post. And he's here visiting the campus to talk about this very subject a little bit later on today. And who's good enough to come by here and talk with us? Questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We talked a little earlier about how newspapers, for example, are looking at blogs. Some of their reporters have them, and they're offered, I'm sure, on the newspapers' websites. So they're getting into blogging themselves, or some of their reporters and staff people are getting into it. Obviously, newspapers like yours and others have to pay attention at least to some blogs. I'm sure that in newsrooms and reporters on their own are actually reading the blogs. They're looking to see what these sources are saying, both because they see them as competition and just, you know, to know what it is that people are saying out there. Are there other ways in which you think that the business of journalism, quote-unquote mainstream journalism, is changing because of blogs? Or maybe it's just that you acknowledge the fact that it's real, it's there, it's influential, and it's something that you have to pay attention to.
I think journalism is changing a lot. I'm not sure that, you know, like looking yourself in the mirror every morning, you don't see the change quite so easily. But I think that, for example, I was reading a blog over the weekend in order to prepare the speech that I'm going to give later today. And the woman who was writing the blog said, well, I was late coming to the Eason Jordan controversy, at least in blogosphere terms. That meant that she was 3 days late. Now, newspapers are responsible for covering a wide panoply of stories nationally, locally, internationally. We sometimes take 3 days, 3 months, occasionally a year to report something because we're trying to verify, we're trying to understand, we're trying to be comprehensive. In the blogging world, you know, 3 days is death, essentially. And you know this when you're going in. I mean, the contract that you have with your community, and I would argue all writers have some contract with their readers. Readers understand when they pick up a newspaper basically how it's been put together. There are editors. There are filters. Reporters don't get to write everything they desire. In the blogging community, you understand that when you're reading it, you're not reading something that was filtered. It may be something like a college kid's online journal. I have two kids in college, and I've read some online journals, and you know it's basically a chronicle of what I did yesterday. But in the Eason Jordan CBS affair, they were demanding attention to themselves and to their views. And when we see other people who are ahead of us in perceiving what the news is behind something, then we're going to be competitive with them. We're going to start paying attention to them. We think that our readers, How do newspapers remain essential in this world? That's essentially what we're talking about. And one of the ways they remain essential is to be more vital than anything else. So if a blogger is at spring training, for example, just to use something that's non-controversial, and giving you a better view of the Chicago White Sox's spring training than the Chicago Tribune is, the Tribune's going to get worried about that, and it's going to respond in some way. The question is whether we're constitutionally capable or whether we lose our other readers because we become faster, more superficial, less interested in verifying things. That's the challenge of newspapers, is whether they can survive in the world by being all things to all people, which is essentially what a mass medium tries to be. I don't think it's possible.
Yeah.
I think we have to make a choice.
Well, here, I got a caller, and I want to get to them in a moment here, so I'll promise them I won't make them wait too much longer here. But just sort of one further question. There was a time in journalism when reporters got a chance to catch their breath. The major in the broadcast world, the major news deadline, I suppose, was the 5:30 or 6 o'clock or whenever the networks did their casts. And for newspapers, there was one major edition, and it went to print, and then it went out, and everybody could go, okay, let's think about what we've done. Let's actually sit down and read the paper we made. When cable news came along, now that meant that the cycle is continuous. There is no catching of the breath. And it seems that what happens now with bloggers is that just makes it that much quicker, that somebody with a blog could be updating it every half an hour, every 20 minutes. Things now move so fast, and I think that's the concern of a lot of people in the business of journalism, is the things that move so fast, and there's so much competition, even more competition than before, to be first, that it doesn't give you the opportunity to think as carefully, to check your story as carefully. And so there's this greater risk of stories being put out that you might say, if we had a little bit more reflection or had more time to check and to think about it, we might not have done that story, or we might have done it differently.
Well, I remember the days where being live on television was about the most scary thing you could possibly be. Mm-hmm. Now, if we don't update our website constantly, readers either go away from our website, Washington Post has its own website, or they think there's something wrong, they actually call and say, you haven't updated the website in 5.5 minutes. I'm glad I work for a weekly section, because what we do is we think for about 3.5 days, and then we begin to assemble it all together into something you get on Sunday. I think readers are smart. I think they look for what they need, and they're not going to go off looking for a blog for certain kinds of stories. You're asking the question, I think, very, very perceptively, do we end up committing journalism that we wished we hadn't, that we would want to retract on? And I think there's going to be more and more of that. I was involved in a story back in 1992 where there were allegations that we had received about unwanted sexual advances by Senator Robert Packwood. This was in the days when I was doing investigative editing. And we could not confirm the story to our satisfaction, when the rules that we had used was that we were going to have at least 3 on-the-record sources, not even on background, before we published the story. We couldn't do that before the election. We decided not to publish the story. We published it 3 weeks after the election. You know, of course, that senators are elected for 6-year terms. And we were excoriated in parts of the journalism community for withholding, quote-unquote, this information from Oregon voters so they could make a choice. We didn't like the situation we were in, but we just did not have the story ready. Now, 10-12 years, 1992, so we're 13 years later, I suspect that the bloggers would have been reporting the allegations long before we had ever done any, quote, verification. What we would be doing? Would we be reporting on the blogging allegations instead of trying to verify the facts for ourselves? Got me.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with a caller here in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I'm retired, so I have 24/7, to look at blogs. And I did that for a very short period. Then I decided, oh, this is ridiculous. I don't know who the hell these people are. And, of course, in my conspiracy mind, I figured the Republicans have already got a number of them set out with nefarious names like Clear Skies, putting out information. So I rely on New York Times, Washington Post, basically for my information, and public radio. what concerns me is, you know, just the actual operation. I mean, how do you decide which blogger to read to get information you think that is possibly accurate or could give you some direction to make further investigation? And secondly, I think there's a great field here for bloggers and what Bush administration's introduced, the new encapsulated news thing given to the TV stations here. Here's a fake reporter. There's a lot of stuff in here. It's fake, but it's good stuff, and you can run it, and it's less than a minute, so get on with it. And I could see bloggers getting involved in that, too. And then I can see, you know, them changing photographs and putting on the web, you know, like in the movie that was done back when Woody Allen was running around with a lot of high-named people in the movie. I just wonder if you could sort of give a general comment about that. Personally, my vote is for the Post and the Times and NPR. But with these young kids, it has to be immediate satiation sometimes, and this is really a great place for a fascist state to start.
Well, we're all in favor of your vote. We love readers like you who think that we're still the bomb, as the kids would say. I was at a panel discussion recently with a blogging focus, and one of the bloggers was a woman whose name is Anna Marie Cox, who goes by the name Wonkette. And she writes a lot of humorous stuff about Washington. Somebody in the audience who was also retired and who reads the Post, it was a Washington audience, said directly to her, face to face, "Why should I bother to read you? I mean, who are you? Why should I care what you have to say?" And Anna Marie, who's, you know, quite charming, answered with a lot of aplomb and said, "You shouldn't. If you don't have any interest in what I have to say, don't read me. Read me because I'm funny. Read me because I'm saying something that you haven't read anywhere else. But, you know, don't spend more than a few minutes with me if you don't care." That's an easy thing to say. And I laughed and said in response to her, I said, "You know, you're more of a journalist than you make out to be, because you're trying to write about the things that are going on in Washington. And I think you're trying to escape the responsibilities of being a journalist by saying, well, don't read me, I'm just a humorist." Why should you spend any time with this? You know, I think that we should play to our strengths. Our strength is that we have a large news organization with a lot of resources in which we are selling you our credibility. And the more we go toward the blogging sensibility, the less credibility that we will have. And I have no reason to think that we're going to do that. The blogging that we're doing is really supplemental, you know, writing from spring training about what you've seen during a day. It's kind of what we would call notes in the profession. You're filing your notes. And the professional journalists are smart enough not to file notes on things that they haven't checked out.
Let's talk with someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Yeah, I've been more active on not so much reading the blogs, but more active on these reading bulletin boards and discussion forums. And I would just there have been lots of these forums where I would just swear that one individual or two individuals on the forum just seemed like somebody was paying them to say what they were saying. I couldn't imagine anybody possibly, you know, actually believing or caring about what some of these individuals were saying. And I'm wondering, you know, about is somebody spoofing, you know, on these things? Are there entities, you know, we talk about the democratization of the internet. Are there these large government or corporate entities or maybe political entities that are out there, you know, spoofing, you know, pretending to be private individuals, but you know, kind of pushing some kind of agenda?
Well, I can tell you one specific example. You're absolutely right. It's a very good question. In Maryland, where I live, Governor Ehrlich is the governor now, and an aide of his was just fired for his comments on, really, I guess, a discussion forum more than a blog, called FreeRepublic.com, where he was under a pseudonym. I mean, everybody uses a pseudonym, so that itself isn't nefarious. Passing along rumors, there's some question about whether he started the rumors, but passing along rumors about the mayor of Baltimore, who's a Democrat, Governor Ehrlich is a Republican. And these, it's the kind of thing that, without any proof, it made the governor and his aide look worse than it made the mayor. But he was definitely posing as nobody knew who he was. FreeRepublic.com is a more Republican-oriented website, so you could go there and say, well, you know, I understand why they're chatting about Mayor O'Malley. But what was happening was is the rumor was now filtering into the mainstream. And I ran into a number of people in Baltimore, where I live, I commute to Washington, who absolutely believe that the mayor had a love child, which was part of the rumor. And there's no proof for it at all. And the newspapers have been checking it out, in fact, wasting resources, I think, for a year, including hounding a woman who was allegedly the mom, to the point where she was at her wits' end because she kept getting calls from reporters.
Yeah, I seem to remember that one book called Bush's Brain about Karl Rove. I seem to remember one passage, not that they had proof, but kind of suggesting or wondering about one incident where somebody had been posting onto a forum, and it was just the handle that the poster used and the content seemed suspiciously familiar based on Rove's MO, but I guess that's just a rumor. Anyway, you can go ahead and talk about it. I'd like to hear about it some more if you have anything more to say, but I'll hang up and just listen.
All right, thanks for the call.
I was just going to add that, we don't want to blame technology for the techniques that have been around for a long time. Dirty tricks, Donald Segretti in the Watergate era, when he was doing some of his things, they use whatever technology is available to them. And so it's no surprise that they're going to use the web for that. There's no surprise that they'll try to leak things to newspaper reporters who aren't smart enough to realize that they're being manipulated and it'll appear in the newspaper.
Well, I'm thinking about going back to the example that you gave. Supposing that there is some story, that there are a lot of prominent bloggers that are spending a lot of time writing about it, and maybe it is a story that has to do with political scandal. Who knows what it is? And you're in your judgment and judgment of the people at the Post and other places, you might say, this is just I doubt the story, I doubt their facts, I don't really think it's very important. I can think of 20 stories that it's more important for us to be reporting on. Should we spend our resources trying to chase down this story and determine is it true, is it not, or should we say, you know, that's just not important, there are these other things that we should be doing? Do we risk someone looking at us and saying, well, you know, you guys, you're just really not doing it because here's this very important story over here. All these people are spending a lot of time talking about it. Why aren't you on that story?
That's what happens. We get accused of cover-up and we get lots of calls from people. And eventually, in part because there is enough of the world that is ideologically based, that eventually you're going to get accused of not reporting on something. We don't have to check everything out. But at some point, critical mass is reached, and you just say, well, often there's some kernel of truth to things that seem unusual, distorted, fantastic. Let's try to get to the bottom of this. So we're stuck. And in one sense, though, it's good. Why is it good? Because the public is turning to newspapers, television perhaps, radio, as the truth tellers. We hear this rumor. We want you to tell us the truth one way or the other. We have sort of an ethic in the profession, and we don't print rumors to tell you that they're not true. You know, I'm sure that you wouldn't want to be the subject of a rumor and have us tell you, well, here's the rumor, and it's not true, but it gets in the paper anyway. But this is our function, and so I'm glad that the newspaper is considered to be the truth teller, although as we see with these public opinion surveys, we're also regarded as being less trustworthy than car dealers these days. So I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah. Let's go to another caller here, line number two. Hello.
I think you're what you've answered my question. My idea was to suggest that newspapers have a section just for this purpose, labeled clearly as untested and notes and so forth. But then rumors might get in there, so that would be a danger.
I agree with you.
Did you have further comment, Carl?
Not on that. I had a question on the CBS blogging, and that is, it seems to me that if somebody wanted to set up CBS, they would have the bloggers ready to go. And it seemed that the response was so fast that it's almost as though the whole thing was set up by somebody who wanted it to go this way. In other words, the CBS became the story rather than the content of the phony letter.
Well, I doubt that it was a setup, although I think that it's possible that it could have occurred that way. CBS, if you read the report or you heard any news accounts of the report of the investigation, it made it easy on people to go after them because they just didn't do the kinds of steps that they ought to have done, and they ignored red flags. When they went to their own document verification experts, they didn't take them seriously enough, and it just seemed like a sort of, let's check the box off and say we talked to some experts, but they really didn't look hard at those documents to see whether or not they were accurate.
Okay. Well, back to the first thing, it might be interesting to readers if journalists would say that we need verification on something. Can anybody help us? And if that appeared in the paper, you might get a lot more notes to the letters and so forth and interest in if you can do that without spreading rumors, you know.
That's an interesting idea.
All right. Well, again, thanks for the call.
Bye.
We have somebody else here waiting, and I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're a little bit past the midpoint of the conversation. Steve Luxenberg is assistant managing editor of The Washington Post. He is responsible for the Outlook section. That's a section of analysis and commentary that appears on Sundays. Before that, he directed the Post investigative special projects staff, and before that, spent a number of years working for the Baltimore Sun. Questions are welcome. Here we're talking about, has started out talking about the weblogs, the blogs, and what they mean for quote-unquote mainstream media and big newspapers like the Washington Post. Questions welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Urbana, next caller here on line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. I was a little bit surprised to hear the moderation in which you designated Free Republic as a more Republican website. They are an out-and-out 100% extremist Republican website, which exists for no other purpose than to slander Democrats and like-minded people. For instance, one of their directors, Mary Spaeth, a former child actress, not that that has anything to do with it, but I saw her in The World of Henry Orient. Anyway, she was responsible for, partly responsible for funding the Swift Boat, those Swift Boat films, for one thing.
Well, this is why I'm glad that people are listening and calling in, because you actually know a heck of a lot more about that specific site than I do. I was just being moderate because I was being cautious.
Oh, yes. Well, I do read the blogs. We have unrestricted access to the Internet in the building I live in due to our very generous manager. And so I keep up with that very much. Mm-hmm. I find things, you have to look at them, you have to read them with caution, because what it is conversation. It's not really journalism. It's conversation verging on journalism.
I agree with you. I think that's the fulcrum on which this rests, is that I've learned lots of interesting things about the blogs, because let's face it, there are lots of people with expertise out there who are just freely giving of that advice and expertise, and why wouldn't you find something interesting? Of course you would. But in terms of checking out, journalism is at essence the observation of events. We're witnessing events, and we're testing evaluating things constantly. If someone's sitting in their apartment building and writing their opinion about something, and they're dependent on just the rumors and other blogs that they're reading, you know, they may or may not have something interesting to say, but it's not going to be something that is journalism. But in the cases that we've been talking about, the blogs in CBS and the blogs on Easton Jordan, they really were pushing into journalism, because they were asking for action to be taken. They weren't just giving commentary.
Most definitely, and I understand, although I wasn't really into the blogs at that time, but that the scandal about Trent Lott, what he said about Strom Thurmond, was apparently that was first talked about a good deal on the Internet, and only then did it get into the mainstream media.
That's correct. My understanding of what happened with Trent Lott, where he talked about it, I hope I'm right about this, it would have been better had Strom Thurmond won for president. He said this at a birthday party celebration.
Yes.
It was actually reported by a journalist who does not have a job at a newspaper, but who would like one, who had started his own Capitol Hill, I wouldn't call it a blog because he's actually trying to commit journalism, and that's what he had gone to this event, I don't think he actually was at the event, but he had talked to a lot of people who had been at the event. Well, there's no real difference there between what newspapers do and what he was doing, except for the fact that his news judgment was such that he thought it was more newsworthy, I guess, than whoever else had heard the comment.
Yes, and it's conversation, a sort of cross of conversation and journalism, because you will hear a lot of gossip and rambling chatter that just has to be filtered and looked at. You can't take it as 100% gold.
That's
people
right.
We'll tell you the exactly opposite thing with great fury and passion on both sides.
Welcome to my world.
Yes. Okay. Well,
all right.
I find things that have turned out to be very true and useful to learn on the Internet that I've never seen in mainstream media. I'm sorry to insult your
you're not insulting me at all. That sounds like not only a factual statement, but one that's common sense. Of course you would find those things. But you're very discerning about what you think about it, whether it's you call it conversation rather than journalism, and that's the most important point.
Okay, right. Bye-bye.
All right, thank you. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Let me give you our numbers again, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line so that if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And here's someone else calling from the campus, line number 2. Hello.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right, great. Yeah, I've been taking issue with almost everything you've said, actually. I find a lot of problems with the mainstream media, like a lot of other people. Whenever you say that the alternative media, you know, doesn't check its facts, I don't think the mainstream media is too good at it either. You talk about being fooled by the institutions and organizations. But I think the mainstream media, if not as equally gullible, is perhaps more gullible. And this continuous rant you have against a position that the mainstream media has about not allowing for the possibility of concerted group effort, also known as conspiracy, just makes the field ripe for conspiracy and for the kind of stuff that... these people, particularly in the covert area, are good at, you know, inserting little bits of killer factoids. And I want to test your ability to sort out the, I guess before I do that, I wanted to say the CBS thing, for example. To my knowledge, at least I've heard, that nobody has actually found that the documents in question were actually proven to be false. Instead, what happened was this one of these factoids was put out there that it couldn't have been true because the type font was incorrect for the period. Well, I'd put much emphasis on this, but the only kind of people that keep that kind of information are the intelligence agencies. You know, and criminal investigation bureaus, that kind of thing, and they're just the type that would put out a negative, what I'd call a little factoid. But let me ask you, and I want to hang up after this. I just wanted to ask you. I'll test your ability to not be made a fool of and led by the nose. What do you think about what's happened about the pronouncements and etc., discovered facts, quote-unquote, around the death of that, I mean the attack on that Italian journalist in Baghdad at the airport. I'd really like to hear you see if you could find any kind of deliberate effort to mislead there, and I'll hang up. Thank you.
Okay. Well, can you say something about that?
Well, the first thing I would say is that to the caller is I hope I wasn't ranting. I thought I was actually trying to educate and illuminate. I don't have any I think that blogging is quite a useful thing. But I also our job is to try to be as factual and as careful as we can be. And if we're not doing a very good job at it and you're not believing in us, then of course we should do better. In answer to your specific questions, let me take a CBS one first. You're absolutely right. The caller was right in saying that there was no proof in the other direction that the documents were false. But what CBS had to admit to was is that they couldn't prove that they were authentic. And since what they were offering in their initial news report was that they were authentic documents, then they were essentially admitting that they shouldn't have put them on the air to begin with. It's very hard to prove a negative, as we all know. So you don't go forward with a report in which you later on have to say, well, we're really not sure about these things. I'm not sure. I'm reluctant to dip my toe into waters that I don't know much about. I don't know much more about what's going on with the Italian journalist who was, for those callers who weren't aware of this, this is the Italian journalist who was had been a hostage or a kidnapped victim in Iraq. She was being taken to the airport on a highway in the dark by an Italian intelligence agent who was had been the one to, some people think, negotiate, other people think just pick her up essentially and bring her to the airport. There was confusion. There's been much reporting on this, and people are trying to sort it out. The troops opened fire. The U.S. troops manning an impromptu checkpoint that was apparently set up to ensure the safety of Ambassador Negroponte. The Italian agent who shielded the Italian journalist was killed, and she was wounded. We had an article in my section just yesterday by a journalist from Iraq. His point of view was is that checkpoints save lives and that they're important to disrupt terrorism and car bombings because, after all, terrorists and car bombers need to use the roads in order to accomplish their goals, and that the troops have been trained, and he's seen them act very professionally, in trying to make sure that they don't open fire on people who are not terrorists and car bombers because they know the consequences. Of course there are people out there who are, the caller was suggesting that they're conspiracy, people who are trying to change policy, affect the course of events. That's exactly what I'm talking about. We're talking about verification. We are doing the best we can to try to make sure that we're not bringing to you somebody else's manipulated point of view. There are a number of reporters who are trying to sort out, as is the U.S. military, what happened at that checkpoint. And the Post has published a lot of interesting information that would support either the notion that the troops had a car coming after them in the dark that didn't have its lights on, but that and they weren't sure who it was, but they've also reported that there's been disputes about whether the Italian convoy had said that they were coming and the troops were alerted to their presence. I'm sure we'll learn more about this in the next few weeks.
I want to come back to the subject of mainstream media and the internet. When the internet, with the growing popularity of the internet, I think a lot of organizations like the Washington Post, but also CNN, those that were kind of brick-and-mortar news operations said, we have to have an online presence. And so the New York Times and the Washington Post and a lot of other newspapers, news magazines, monthlies, broadcast outlets, everybody started their online operations. So now you can go down to the newsstand and you buy the Washington Post, but you can also go online and read the Washington Post. And organizations said, well, we've got to have an online presence, even though there was some question, I'm sure, about how it is we're going to manage to stay in business if we keep giving the newspaper away like that. Has now that you've had a number of years of online presence, do you think that being online has been good? So let's say just talk about the Washington Post. And being online, has that been good for the Washington Post?
I think on balance it has been good. It has changed things dramatically. The Washington Post, for those of you who have some familiarity with it, does not describe itself as a national newspaper, even though we are regarded as one of the best newspapers in the country. We consider ourselves to be a local newspaper, and for many years that's the way we arrange and organize our news coverage. We have national and international reporters, but we distribute ourselves within the Washington metropolitan area. Unlike the New York Times, we have no national daily edition. You can't buy us easily on the streets of Champaign-Urbana or Chicago or Dallas, Denver. Once we went into the online world, at first our online service, which is WashingtonPost.com, had mostly local hits. But over the years, the balance has shifted, and we now have most of our readership of our online paper from a national audience, and even an international audience. It's wonderful to watch what happens from 9 to 5 during the daytime. We have a huge audience in the United States. From midnight to 5 a.m., we have a huge audience in Europe. So this has, of course, changed the way we do business, and we have three or four reporters who are writing for what we call our continuous news division. The idea of a newspaper having continuous news is, of course, antithetical to what a newspaper used to be. And the continuous news people are staffed throughout the 24-hour cycle in order to update the website with breaking news. These are Post reporters. These are experienced people. We actually put experienced people into these jobs to begin with because we didn't know what we were doing and wanted to make sure that we had the best kind of people. Fred Barbash is one of them. William Branigan is another. They've both been foreign correspondents, and they're now back doing rewrite, you could argue. So we are now changing our business model, not that I want to start talking like a businessman, because of the Internet and not because of our own desires to think that we can do a better business because we can be national and local. So it is a dramatic change for us, and we're still sorting it out. The website makes a little bit of money now, I think, sort of breaks even with the advertising. But this issue of giving the news away for free, I mean, we are training people who are in their 20s to think that they can get news, we the media, not just we the Washington Post, that news is free. And newspapers have never been free. The Washington Post hit a peak of its circulation of 800,000 daily and 1.2 million on Sunday 10 years ago. It has been declining slowly ever since. And it certainly tracks the Internet. It may have something to do with the quality of the newspaper. I hope not. But now it's at about 700,000, and doesn't seem to be holding steady. And I have to believe that most of that is because while the experience of reading online is nowhere near as pleasurable, at least for me, as reading the printed copy, and of course, when they invent a portable device you can take into the bathroom, then we'll probably really be dead. The idea that news is free is something that we cannot turn back from. That's what a lot of younger people think.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone in Decatur here in line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Oh, I tuned in late. You may have already talked about this, but this Jeff Gannon, James Guckert scandal.
Yes, we have not talked about it, actually.
Yeah, well, it's all over the blogs, but there was nothing in the Decatur paper about it. And last week, the editor had a note in the paper that it wasn't news. I'd like you to comment on that, please.
Well, let me ask you a question. Was the Eason Jordan incident in the paper in Decatur? The one about CBS and the news executive who made some comments overseas about
the killing the reporters? Yeah, that was in there.
That was in there. How about the CBS incidents? Of course, once they said they were wrong, I'm sure that
Dan Rather. Yes, that was in there.
I think that I'm not sure whether for callers who aren't sure what we're talking about, the Jeff Gannon. It was a blogger who received White House credentials to be part of the press corps, and he is on the, you know, he's more favorable to the administration, and his ideology is not hidden. He doesn't pretend to be objective. And it raised questions about what kind of review the White House was doing of people to get White House credentials. This is a kind of confusing story to me. I don't think that the White House press corps ought to be restricted to mainstream journalists by any means. He was writing under a pseudonym, which is another issue. As to whether the Decatur paper covers it or not, I mean, you obviously were very interested in it. It is all over the blogs, but the editor of the paper probably is saying, you know, that's one of those inside the Beltway Washington stories that just doesn't interest me. And if it hadn't been all over the blogs, you wouldn't know about it. I guess one way of looking at it is, well, the blogs are providing you with journalism that you're not seeing in your own paper, and you can either think that the newspaper ought to cover everything, or you should say, well, I'm getting some of my news over here, and I'm getting some of my news over there, and I got to look at both of them now in order to keep up with what I want to keep up with. Yeah.
I'm going to jump in here. My apologies to jumping in on the call, but we're simply going to have to stop because we've come to the end of our time. For people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, by the way, our guest, Steve Luxenberg, assistant managing editor of the Washington Post, will be talking on this very subject at noon today in room 144 of Loomis Lab on the U of I campus. That's at the corner of Green and Goodwin, and I am expected that anybody interested in hearing more from him should feel welcome to attend. Could
Absolutely.
Stop by and hear what he has to say. Steve is the assistant managing editor of Outlook. That's a section that appears in the Post on Sunday, a section of analysis and commentary. Thanks very much for being
Thank
here.
You. I've enjoyed it.
The broadcast today is made possible with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, presenting Urbana Uncorked, a special wine tasting event to benefit WILL AM-FM-TV on Saturday, April 2nd from 3 to 7 at the Urbana Civic Center. Dozens of wines, many not readily available in central Illinois, will be featured along with door prizes, silent auction, and more. Tickets available at the door or at the Corkscrew, their number 337-7704. The program today also made possible with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Coming up a little later today on the Afternoon Magazine, with that walk down the aisle, a woman becomes a wife. What does it mean to be a wife? And what happens after? What is, for many women, this rite of passage? Today on the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn talks with social critic Ann Kingston, author of a new book entitled The Meaning of Wife. That'll be in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. In the next part of this show, we'll be talking about athletes and drugs, and hear what it really mean to talk about performance-enhancing drugs. Our guest will be Dr. Gary Wadler. He is a specialist in this area and author of the book Drugs and the Athlete, which is a standard text. He'll be talking with us about the subject in the next hour, so I hope that you'll stick around. Right now, though, we'll take a break for news and update on the markets.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
And with this update on the markets, it's coming up on 10:50.